three or four, but you might want to be within viewing distance of somebody's laptop. Okay, any questions on the previous lecture? Okay, as you know, I hang around here, so do feel free to come by if you have questions. So today, basically I've introduced all the quarks and leptons, or some of them, most of them anyway. I've introduced the question of how experiments are done. And so now it's time to really start thinking about what are the basic equations of strong, weak, and electromagnetic interactions, and what does experiment have to say about the validity of those equations. And so what I'd like to do today is to start with probably the simplest process. We'll start with quantum electrodynamics. I'm going to start with really the simplest process, which is electron-positron annihilation into mu plus mu minus. And I know you folks have been prepping very hard for this in the tutorial. So maybe after all the work you've done in the tutorial, the way I'm going to do it today will be interesting to you. And then it also highlights something else I'd like you to keep in mind as I give these lectures. So once again, my main concern in these lectures is not to teach you quantum field theory, but to teach you about particle physics. So very often I'm going to take shortcuts and use a method that is extremely well adapted to getting a certain answer very quickly, because I really want to actually look at the answer and understand its physics. And so in general, there are two ways, or at least two ways, to get any answer: the kind of chug and slog way, and then some very tricky way. And so I'd like you to understand that you don't have to get everything in the tricky way. Chug and slog works very well, but it's not well adapted to lecturing on the blackboard. So please excuse me for that. If you'd like to know another way of deriving any of the things that I derive in these lectures, just come and tell me. I'll tell you a couple more ways to do it. Okay. So what I'd like to do then is to think about this process of, first of all, just the pure QED process of E plus E minus to mu plus mu minus. Now, you folks all know how to do this using, you start with a Feynman diagram, you take traces, you crunch away at the traces, eventually something simplifies. So I'm going to do it in a different way. And the main concept that's going to be used in this derivation is helicity. Now, helicity is an extremely important concept in particle physics, and it's used in many contexts. First of all, as I said already, helicity is the essential quantum number for massless particles when you discuss their transformation properties under the Lorentz group. So I've already introduced to you the notion that the basic kind of fermion in nature is a Weyl fermion, a two-component object that obeys the Weyl equation. And this field has as its quanta a left-handed spinning massless fermion and a right-handed spinning massless antifermion. And then what we'll do before the end of the course is we're going to build up the whole matter content of the standard model out of objects like this by coupling them together in various ways. And that's the right way to do it, because these things are the fundamental irreducible representations of particles under the Lorentz group. Now, when we talk about massive particles, the helicity is generally indefinite. And the reason you can see that quite easily, let's say I have a left-handed electron, but it's massive. So if it's massive, I can always view it from another frame where it's at rest, but it's still spinning in the same direction. And if I want, I can even run faster, and then I would see it in another frame where it looks like this. It's now going backwards, but it's still spinning in the same direction. So now it's a right-handed particle. So for a massless particle, the helicity is an absolute quantum number, which is a Lorentz invariant. For a massive particle, the helicity is actually indefinite. I can change the helicity by making a Lorentz boost. Nevertheless, helicity is still extremely useful, because if I don't boost through the rest frame, but rather I just do rotations or longitudinal boosts, the helicity is still an invariant. And in general, and we'll see this in the course through many examples, the helicity amplitudes tend to be the simplest way of looking at any given process. So what I'd like to do now is to attack this e plus e minus to mu plus mu minus from the point of view of its helicity amplitude. So I just want to go and compute explicitly the amplitude for electrons of definite helicity to produce muons of definite helicity. And then those expressions, when we get them, will be, the physics will be quite obvious. And so that's good. Whenever you can make the physics obvious, that's good. OK, so with that introduction, let's get to work on this diagram. So in lowest order, there's only one diagram, K1, K2, K3, K4. The momenta here go in and go out like that, and the arrows indicate the flow of the lepton number, quantum number. So this will be the electron down here, the positron, the mu minus, and the mu plus. And then you can all write down the value of this amplitude. It's minus I e squared, v bar of k4 gamma mu u, sorry, u bar of k3 gamma mu v of k4 minus I over, this momentum here is q squared, v bar of k2 gamma mu u of k1. Very explicitly, this is, of course, electrodynamics. The photon couples to currents. And this is a current-current interaction. So the easiest way to actually get this into a form that's useful is to compute the explicit form of these current expectation values for helicity states. And so let me just take a little time to do that. So I'm going to choose the basis for gamma matrices, which is used in my book. So sigma mu is 1 sigma, and sigma bar mu is 1 minus sigma. And so then we can just basically write the Dirac equation and get the Dirac spinners very straightforwardly. So, for example, let's consider an electron, K1. I'm going to use massive electrons for the moment. In a while, I'll set the electron mass equal to 0. But it's not much harder in the massive case. So the electron is coming in along the 3-axis with momentum K and energy E. The Dirac equation is, is the Dirac equation for u of k will be k slash minus m equals 0. Just plugging everything in, we can write this equation explicitly as minus m e minus k sigma 3, e plus k sigma 3, and minus m acting on u is equal to 0. And now it's pretty easy to get the solution of that equation. Sigma 3 appears here. So we'll have a different answer if the spin is up or the spin is down along the 3-axis. The particle is moving along the 3-axis. So those are just the helicity states. If the spin is up along the 3-axis, this is e minus k and this is e plus k. So for helicity plus a half, the solution is obviously the square root of e minus k, the square root of e plus k, times 1, 0. And if the helicity is down along the 3-axis, you just reverse this.
easy.
In the limit of zero mass, these formulae obviously degenerate. E minus k is equal to zero. E plus k is 2e. And so what you get is a two-component equation. This two-component equation is exactly the Weyl equation, which I wrote here. There's one more thing to check, which is that these states are correctly normalized in the usual convention for U's. And, well, just believe me, it's correct. Okay. If we've got the U's, we can also get the V's very easily. And so that's a very straightforward extension of this exercise. The V's obey the equation k slash plus m equals 0. Now I'm going to do something that's a little tricky, so just follow me on this. The vector I'd like to put in here is the vector going in the other direction. Because if the electron's coming this way, the positron to collide with it has to be coming the other way. So I'm going to put, I'm going to solve the V equation with this vector. And so then the Dirac equation is not this one, but E plus K sigma, E minus K sigma M. And the solutions are then the same, except that there's some interchange of the pluses and minuses. And also, because this is a plus m and not a minus m, there'll be some extra minus signs in the equation. So one of the v of k's will be the square root of e minus k, the square root of e plus k, times 0, 1. And the other one will be the square root of e plus k, the square root of e minus k, 1, 0. OK, so that's the sign in here is reversed from what's over there. And then I need a minus sign here. OK. And now there's a somewhat tricky question. OK, which is which? And so let's analyze this carefully. We're now going in the minus 3 direction. OK. So an up spin corresponds to actually this spinner, right? And if I think of this as being rotated, I probably should put a minus sign here. So these two spinners are rotated from the up and down spinners in the other direction. So this is spin up along the minus 3 axis, and this is spin down along the minus 3 axis. However, the v is actually the wave function of the hole. And the wave function of the electron. And you get the positron by kicking that electron out and making a hole. So the helicity, the spin in the spinner, is opposite to the spin in the antiparticle. And so with all that, this is the helicity equals minus 1 half state, and this is the helicity equals plus 1 half state. Whew. OK, now we've got all that straight. Maybe I should just record these over here on the blackboard, because we'll use them now. So for an electron going in the plus 3 direction, the helicity plus a half, I'm going to do this the other way around. The helicity minus a half is the square root of e plus k, the square root of e minus k, times 0, 1. The helicity plus a half is the square root of e minus k, the square root of e plus k, times 1, 0. For a positron in the minus 3 direction, the helicity minus a half is the thing I wrote here. OK, if you're really a fan of Sorry, did I get this right? Yes, okay. Yeah, if you're really a fan of... Here, I'm really sorry. If you're really a fan of helicity amplitudes, you might want to work these out once and for all, put them in a piece of paper and carry it around with you wherever you go. And I've been known to do that. I still get confused. Spin is tricky. Minus, minus. Okay.
State.
Sorry?
Is it clear that this is all going to be in a state? Senior electron is not in a pure state.
Yes.
So you don't know what's going
to happen. Oh, well, we'll take care of that. We'll take care of that later. See, the nice thing about helicity is you're in a pure state. Pure states are much easier to think about. So when we end up with a beam, of course, is an incoherent mixture of the two helicities, unless it's a polarized beam. And so we have to take an appropriate average. So we will do that, but not. Okay. So now we have all our ingredients. Everything is great. So now what I'd like to do is just to compute the objects that appear in this equation. So let's first think about the massless case. Mass is equal to zero. Then what you see is that these expressions degenerate. So this is zero, and this is zero. Now, maybe I should write out V bar gamma mu u. This is V dagger gamma zero gamma mu u, which is equal to V dagger, in the conventions I'm using, sigma bar sigma u. So what's inside here? The gamma matrices are diagonal in this two-component space. So if I get 0 here, it gets multiplied by that. That would be 0. This multiplied by that would be 0 in the massless case. So actually, the current has 0 matrix element with a left-handed electron and a left-handed positron. That's what was getting me confused a moment ago, but now I've got it straightened out. So the only matrix elements that are non-zero are going to be with a left-handed electron and a right-handed positron, or vice versa. And now we can easily work those out. So if I have a left-handed electron and a right-handed positron, this object, I'm going to get a square root of 2e, and it's going to get squared. I'm going to get, for the right-handed positron, you see a minus 1, 0, a 1 minus sigma. There's another minus 1. No, I've already got it. And then a 0, 1. And when you multiply all that out, you get this, 2e 1 minus 1, 0. And the other combination that's non-zero is the right-handed electron with the left-handed positron. And again, copying from over there, 0, 1, 1 minus sigma, 1, 0, we're going to get minus 2e, 0, 1, I, 0. For certain purposes, you have to worry about the overall signs of these helicity amplitudes. But those are not going to be important in today's lecture. They're all going to get squared. So don't get too hung up on it. If you have polarized things in the final state, sometimes you have to worry about that. But for today, it's really the form of this expression which is important. And the other two cases are zero. By the way, statement that a left-handed electron always annihilates on a right-handed positron is sometimes called helicity conservation. And when you're dealing with massless particles, that's often a very important guide to how things are actually going to work. Okay, well, now it's pretty clear what's going on. We should introduce some polarization vectors along the three axis. So in particular, let's write E left is this, and E right is this. And these are actually the spin 1 polarization vectors with J3 equals minus 1 and J3 equals plus 1. And for good measure, let me write epsilon 0. So that's the vector with J3 equals 0. So now I have the three polarization vectors along the three axis. These things satisfy epsilon I star dot epsilon j is equal to delta ij times minus 1. Okay, and then you see that this one here is exactly two e times the square root of 2 times epsilon left, and for e right e left, we get 2e times the square root of 2 times this minus sign that I told you not to worry about times epsilon right. And this is exactly right, because this guy here, there's an electron with negative spin annihilating a positron also with spin in the other direction. So it sums up to a total jz equals minus 1. So the virtual photon here has jz equals minus 1, so it's now obvious. And similarly over here, the electron has positive helicity. The positron has negative helicity, but it corresponds to a positive jz spin. And then this adds up to a virtual photon, which has 1 unit of angular momentum in that direction. And the formulae are just telling you that explicitly. OK? And now the only thing left to do is to work out the answer for the massive case. Now, in the massive case, we're now going to get this times this. So E plus k times E minus k is equal to E squared minus k squared, which is equal to the mass. And so now the other amplitudes are going to come in, but they're going to be proportional to the mass, or if you like, they're explicitly down by a factor of m over E relative to these. And well, why don't I just write the answer? For the massive case, E left, E right, E left is equal to E right is equal to 2m times the third polarization vector, as it has to be. Okay? Wow, that's incredibly simple. So now we're very set up to use these in order to compute amplitudes. And so now I guess what I would like to do is just to take these expressions I have here, here, and here, and plug them into that equation. And then we will immediately get the amplitudes for E plus E minus annihilation to mu plus mu minus. So maybe what we should do is first start out in the massless case. So I'm going to now set the mass of the electron equal to 0 and set the mass of the muon equal to 0. And then that expression over there is I e squared, q squared is the center of mass energy squared. From now on, I'm going to use the notation that the center of mass energy squared is going to be called S. And so let me just do that, save us some writing. So this is S. And then if I, so that takes care of everything but these two matrix elements. So this one now, let's compute this for the case of a left-handed electron and a right-handed positron going to a left-handed muon and a right-handed muon. So then I'm going to get, for each case, this factor of square root of 2 times 2e. So that's, when I square it, it's 2e is the center of mass energy, 2s. And then what I get left is, from this thing over here, there's one of these left-handed polarization vectors. And this thing is just the complex conjugate of that. So here I'm going to get a left-handed polarization vector complex conjugate. And now there's just one more thing that I have to take care of, which is that if the electrons come in along this axis and the muons go out along an axis rotated by theta, then I'm going to have to take this calculation and rotate it through that rotation. So let me write this as EL mu of theta. And I think at this point we are done. That is the complete answer. So in order to actually interpret these answers, all we have to do is to know what these rotated vectors are. And let me just make a little list on here, and then we'll have all the resources. So I told you that EL is 1 over root 2, 0, 1, minus I, 0. E0 is this, and ER is this. Can everybody see the bottom line here? If you can't see the bottom line, it's just the complex conjugate of this line, which I hope everybody can see. Is that okay? And then if I rotate these through an angle theta, I get cosine minus I minus sine. I'm doing the rotation in the 1-3 plane. For this one, I'm going to get sine cosine. So this is in the direction of the rotated axis. And for the bottom one, as I said before, the complex conjugate of the top one for people who can't see it. Okay. And now if I dot the complex conjugate of this vector into this one, which is what it says to do there, then that times that is 1. That times that is cosine theta. There's a minus sign because it's a Lorentz dot product. And so this object here is 1 half times minus times 1 plus cosine theta. Okay. Well, now we are just doing truly excellently. The S's cancel. The factor of 2 even cancels. And what we get is then E minus left, E plus right, going to mu minus left, mu plus right, the E value of the amplitude. Let me just make this a little smaller. Is minus I e squared times 1 plus cosine theta. And physically, that's just exactly right. Because as I said before, when the electron and positron collide, they have a 1 unit of angular momentum. When the muons go out, they suck up 1 unit of angular momentum. And so then what you have is just the D matrix, the angular momentum rotation matrix through the angle theta. And that's exactly what this is. It's by angular momentum conservation, it's got to vanish in the backward direction because the angular momenta are totally incompatible. It's going to be maximal in the forward direction. And then halfway in between, there's the quantum mechanical angular momentum relation, which is just this expression. OK, well, now we can just write the other answers. Or you can work them out using these methods. Let me always start with an E left, E right initial state. So mu, mu, the answer is I E squared 1 minus cosine theta. I think if I got the minus sign right, there's no minus sign here. But again, that isn't going to matter. So this thing vanishes in the forward direction, and it's maximal in the backward direction, so that the relevant angular momenta line up. And in the massive case, actually, it's not different. So if I relax this assumption, these two answers turn out to be the same. And let me just write this, and then, OK. So if I relax this assumption, you can redo the calculation. These two answers turn out to be the same. And you also generate amplitudes to mu left, and mu right, both of which are equal to minus IE squared. And then there's an M over E and a sine theta, which is the dot product of this expression with that one. OK. Now we're basically done the calculation. So, sir, you had a question.
I was just wondering, you probably said it, but I think I just missed it. What's S in this?
Oh, so S is always going to be the center of mass energy squared. So it's also for 2E quantity.
Thank you.
Okay. And you guys in the back had a question. So tell me, S.
Yeah, my question was I was expecting the amplitude to depend on S.
Yes?
Okay,
so you did this elaborate dimensional analysis, and you'll remember that this amplitude is dimensionless. And for the massless case, there's no scale except the energy of the electrons. So if it's dimensionless and the only dimensionful parameter is the energy, it has to cancel out. Good question. Now, for the so these things here are called the helicity flip amplitudes, because they violate helicity conservation. And so they're an explicit factor of M over E. So these vanish in the massless case. Now, in principle, the coefficient here could also depend on M over E. It just turns out it doesn't. OK. The next calculation that you do, it will. So it's not a general. But for the massless case, this has to be dimensionless, so it can't depend.
Clarify, the scattering angle is defined from the electron to the muon?
Yeah, so the electron goes in this way, the muon comes out that way, and the scattering angle is the angle by which the muon is deflected. Okay. Yes?
So the first two equations don't change in the case where the muon.
The first two equations, you'll see, it's exactly the same in the massive case. Basically, what happens is you get E plus K. Yeah. And then when you work out all the minus signs, you get E minus K. And E plus K plus E minus K is well known to be 2.
So if I send the mass of my muon to infinity, it doesn't change anything?
Well, something else will change. But this amplitude doesn't change. Obviously, if you send the mass of the muon to infinity, you may not have enough energy to make muons.
Well, that's my point.
And then you're going to get
kind of
zero.
I'm expecting that to happen somewhere here, but I guess it will come somewhere else.
No, it happens somewhere else. And maybe it's time to talk about that. So this is just the amplitude. Then, as you know, to make a physical prediction, you have to take the amplitude and turn it into a cross-section. And so now we have all the amplitudes. We can do that. OK?
Sorry, can you just explain on your vertices, on the bottom right of the right-hand board, the arrows on your fermion lines?
There are arrows used for all different purposes. Yeah. So here the arrows indicate the direction that the particle is moving. Okay. The actual fermion number is always flowing this way. So the arrow in a Feynman diagram would look like that. But I drew the arrows this way because we're interested in where the particles are actually going. Okay. And then the little arrows here are the spins. So here I have a right-handed electron. Oh, sorry. It's this hand. A right-handed electron is spinning. Okay? Okay. Silence. Well, we made a lot of progress because we've taken this Feynman diagram and we've reduced it to some incredibly simple expressions. And so now we just need to apply these expressions and get some physical predictions. But of course, you guys have worked this already, so I'd just like now to connect this up to things that you already know. Okay. So as you all know, once you have the scattering amplitude, you can turn that into a cross-section. So a cross-section is the basic coin for elementary particle physics. You take a beam of particles, you collide it with either a block of some other kind of particles or a beam of some other kind of particles. Every particle in the target presents some effective cross-sectional area to a particle in the beam, and so the cross-section is that measure of scattering effectiveness of a particle B with respect to a beam particle A. And there's a formula for the cross-section that I guess Callum has now drilled you on, which is this. Namely, you take the matrix element, so this is the S matrix element, you integrate it over phase space. If this is relativistically normalized, this should be relativistically normalized, and that's extremely convenient. And those are the conventions that, by the way, I've been using, and they're the conventions in my book. So each of these will be a Lorentz invariant object. Then this EA and EB reflects the relativistic normalization of the initial states. And then a cross-section is proportional. You have to divide. It's a cross-section times a flux is equal to a rate. So you have to somehow divide by the rate at which particles are coming together. And so the relative velocity comes in. And in chapter 4 of my book, there's a very detailed derivation of this equation using wave packets. And so what I would say is, if you don't believe this equation, you should work through that. But I'm not going to explain it any further here. In any case, it's dimensionally correct. It's relativistically invariant, except for this piece, which it turns out is actually invariant under longitudinal boosts. And then under transverse boosts, it transforms the right way. So an area, if you transversely boost it, is length contracted. So it's a great expression. And then if we have some specific cases, it gets easier. So first of all, if I have massless initial particles in a colliding beam situation where they're back to back, this becomes 2, and the whole thing collapses to 2 times the center of mass energy squared. And then if I have two body final state, then the integral over phase space has a very simple form. It's dimensionless, and it's equal to 1 over 8 pi times the integral d cosine theta over 2 times the momentum of a final particle, or maybe I should write 2 times the momentum divided by the center of mass energy. So two-body phase space reduces to this simple expression. And then finally, we have the matrix element squared. Let me take this 2 and suck it into here. And this formula is not a bad one to memorize. You'll want it at your fingertips. Yes?
What is the D there?
Oh, I'm sorry. D sigma, I should have written. So D means if I have a particle detector out here that detects the muon, I'll integrate over the range of cosine theta that detector spans.
Right.
And so I'll integrate this equation.
I was just confused because there is a D on the right and not on the left.
Right. You're absolutely right. It should be like this. And then you take your detector, you integrate over the range of cosine theta in which you detect the muons, and you get a physical prediction. Okay. We're almost done. All I really have to do now is to take this expression and plug in the squares of these expressions. And very conveniently, e squared squared over 16 pi is equal to pi alpha squared. And so there's not much left to say. So we get d sigma d cosine theta for e left, e right, to mu plus mu minus, all states, is equal to 1 over 2s pi alpha squared. And then the square of the other stuff in here, there's a k over e. And then the square of the other stuff in here, which is 1 plus cosine theta squared plus 1 minus cosine theta squared plus m over e squared. And then there are two of these amplitudes, so I should multiply by 2 times sine squared theta. Okay, well, now I've summed over the final polarizations. Now I have to take into account this fact that we talked about before, that in a typical experiment, though not everyone, the beams are unpolarized, so they're an incoherent mixture of E left and E right, E plus left and E plus right. Now, the answer at this level is exactly the same, as you can check, for right and left. But then there are the two combinations that don't annihilate, left, left, and right, right. So you have to multiply this expression by 2 and then divide by 4 to get the incoherent beam result. And so when you do that, you get this expression. So now I'm polarization averaging over the initial state and summing over the final state. And effectively, what I have to do again is multiply by 2 and divide by 4. And so pi alpha squared, k over e, which is 1 minus m mu squared over e squared to the 1/2, or 4 m mu squared over s. And then this expression here becomes 1 plus cosine squared theta plus m squared over e squared sine squared theta. Maybe I should just write this the other way. Okay. And now we are, that's the final result. If you like, you could take that result and integrate it. Oof. Over cosine theta, and then you would get the total cross section, 4 pi over 3 alpha squared times 1 minus m squared over e squared times 1 plus 1/2 m squared over e squared. So now this answers your question about what happens if the mass of the muon is infinite. So if the mass of the muon, 2m mu, is the threshold, this function will rise from the threshold and there's an s here. It'll rise from the threshold, and then it'll eventually turn over and go like 1 over s. So if the mass of the muon, if the energy is not as high as the mass of the muon, the amplitude is non-zero, but the phase space is zero, so you get nothing. And so this is ECM. Now, there's a really interesting thing here, if you're theoretically minded, that the first term in m squared over e squared here, it cancels the first term in m squared over e squared here. So if you come in from high energy, the first correction actually vanishes. And this is actually profound. But I think if you're interested in this, you should ask me about it offline. But one thing that is true is that this shape of the cross-section is very different for different spins of particles. So if you have spin 0, instead of this expression, you get a different normalization, too. You get 1 minus m squared over e squared to the 3 halves. And for spin 2, you'll get a higher rise. And so you can actually measure the spin of the particle by looking at the shape of its threshold cross-section in E plus E minus. And I think in the slides, page 2, you'll see some data on the tau threshold in E plus E minus measured by an experiment at SLAC called the Delco experiment. And you see that the data is a very nice fit to this formula and a really bad fit to the possibilities where the tau has other spins. So that's part of the evidence that the tau is a lepton, as I described. So, and maybe I should also say over here, in this expression, the massless limit will be a 1 plus cosine theta squared dependence. And so that's pretty clear. It's the 1 plus cosine theta squared from the left to left, and the 1 minus cosine theta squared from the right to right. And so interestingly, if you have a polarized beam, a left-handed polarized beam, all the guys in the forward direction, all the muons will be left-handed. All the muons in the backward direction will be right-handed. That follows directly from angular momentum conservation. Yes? No, no, no. I'm saying that if we had redone the calculation with the muons being spin zero, instead of this shape, we'd have some puny shape like that. Okay. It would be really different. Right, this it's the third power of the threshold.
But it's not fermions in
the final state. Well, how do we know? Right? For the tau, we didn't know whether it was fermion or boson. But this makes it pretty clear it's not spin zero. Okay. Okay, now we've got all the formulae, but now there's some point of physics that I wanted to talk about. This all applies in a very obvious way to leptons. You can test these formulae directly on the mu and, as I said, also on the tau, and everything works. It's quantum electrodynamics. If we understand the charge and the angular momentum quantum numbers of particles, we can do quantum electrodynamics. Quantum electrodynamics works extremely well. For quarks, you may wonder whether quantum electrodynamics works for quarks. So quarks, we know, are strange objects. They live in these hadrons. You can't get them out. So does this formalism make any sense for quarks? So let me discuss that. So first of all, the question is, what do quarks actually look like? So an interesting question is, if you do E plus E minus to hadrons, so you have one of these detectors I told you about last time, and you just ask, what do the events look like in those detectors when hadrons are produced in the final state? What do you see? And so I think if you go to slide 3, you'll see a typical example of E plus E minus to hadrons at 90 GeV in the center of mass. And what you'll see is that the event kind of looks like this, that there's a whole bunch of pions going one way and a whole bunch of pions going the other way. And those pions form a collimated structure. We refer to these structures as jets. But the point is that the pions are not produced all over the map. They're produced in a specific collimated jet. And in a typical event, there are two of them. Sometimes there are more. We'll talk about that later. But usually in these events, there are two back-to-back jets. Well, this is very suggestive, because it suggests that somehow these jets originate from quarks, that the original process was quark-anti-quark production. And the quarks somehow turned into jets. Of course, the quarks can't get out. So when you give them a huge amount of energy and force them out of their confined state, they rip apart the vacuum, create many, many more quark-antiquark pairs. Eventually, everything rearranges into pions. Well, pions, kaons, protons, all kinds of hadrons. But most of the particles coming out in these events, if you look at them, are pions, just because pions are the lightest hadron, and heavy hadrons will quickly decay to pions. You know, some kaons, every 10th particle is a proton or an antiproton, something like that. What's amazing is that the jets stay collimated, that the big momentum transfer is the momentum transfer to the quarks. And then once you've transferred that large momentum to the quarks, there aren't any more large transverse momentum transfers. There's only the splitting up of this momentum into a lot of small pieces, which eventually are the pions. Now, I forgot what the next slide is. Oh, the next slide, I guess, is just another one. Oh, so what page is that? OK. So I think page 2 is the tau. Page 3 is one of these events. Now, here's the most amazing thing. Let's take the electrons, and then we have this jet. So you can easily visually find the axis of the jet, or the centroid of the energy deposition, or something like that. And you can ask the question, what is d sigma d cosine theta for the jet? And the answer is given on slide 4. It is exactly 1 plus cosine squared theta. Maybe I shouldn't say exactly. We'll compute some corrections to this later. But visually, as you see on this slide, it is a 1 plus cosine squared theta distribution. Now, I told you that all the features of this formula depend on spin a half. What comes out is pions. Everything in the final state to a first approximation is a spin zero particle. But the direction of the jet knows about spin a half. And in fact, it gives further confirmation of this picture, that the overall pattern of momentum in these events is set up by the process that involves quarks. And then later, something happens to turn the quarks into pions that doesn't involve any hard momentum transfer. So this is a totally amazing thing. And it's the first thing you should understand about the nature of the strong interactions. The quarks govern the momentum flow, even though the final states are very complex and are made mainly of spin zero particles. OK, now what about the normalization? So let me rewrite the formula here in the massless case. So d sigma d cosine, the total cross-section formula, sigma is equal to 4 pi alpha squared over s. And all these factors become 1 if I'm at energies, in this picture, much higher than the quark masses. So this is the basic unit of cross-section. This is the cross-section for mu pair production, and we'll modify it slightly to make up the cross-section for quark production. In fact, what I'd like to do, this is the cross-section for mu pair production. And so a reasonable experimental technique is to count the quark jet events, count the muon events, divide them, then you get the ratio of cross sections. So let R be E plus E minus to hadrons divided by E plus E minus to muons. And now let's predict this in the quark model. So needless to say, you're now expecting I'm going to do a very sophisticated derivation. But what I'd like to try first is the very simplest thing. Let's, for every quark, this quantum electrodynamics diagram is proportional to the quark charge here. So let's put the square of the quark charge. So that's 1 for a muon. And then you remember I told you, oh no, I didn't tell you this. At the end of the last lecture, I did tell you this. I told you that there's this problem that the baryons are in totally symmetric states, whereas we know that baryons are made of quarks or fermions. They're spin a half. So they have to be in totally anti-symmetric states. So for this reason, we were driven to postulate that actually there are three kinds of quarks, red, blue, and green, we could call them, and that that quantum number is totally anti-symmetrized in a baryon, and then the rest of the quantum numbers then must be totally symmetrized for Fermi statistics. So if that were right, then there could be three kinds of quarks that are produced here. A red and an anti-red, a blue and an anti-blue, or a green and an anti-green. So there should be a factor of 3. And then we should sum this over the number of quarks that we produce. So MQ, 2MQ is less than ECM. So now this is a pretty straightforward computation. 3, the up quark has charge 2/3. The down quark has charge minus 1/3, and the strange quark has charge minus 1/3. And that's equal to 2. If I add another quark, then this number would get larger. OK, so now the question is, what does the data say? So that's on slide 5, I think. And it's totally amazing. There are regions where the data says that this quantity here is flat. And between, so roughly the data looks like this. There's some stuff that happens, which we'll talk about in a moment. Then there's a region between about 2 and 3.5 GeV where this number is flat at a value very close to 2. And that's the green line on the curve. If you are more sophisticated about how you treat the strong interactions in the theory called QCD that I'm going to explain to you later, you get 2 and about a 4%, 5% correction increase. And that's an extremely good fit to the data. Then there are some resonances. Well above the resonances, you settle down to a value which is 3 1/3 plus 5%. And that corresponds to adding another quark, which we'll talk more about next time, called the charm quark. And then there are some more resonances. And then above that, you settle down to a value 3 2/3, which corresponds to adding another minus 1/3 quark called the bottom quark. So locally, this cross-section is very flat. And the demarcation between the flat region is marked by resonances. Now, what should the resonances be? Well, it's obvious what the resonances are at the extreme left of the diagram. These are the particles I told you about before, rho, omega is here, and phi. So if you have E plus E minus annihilation, if I have a pair of quarks, I computed this ignoring the binding interaction of quarks. And somehow that was really OK at very high energy. But at sufficiently low energy, where the quarks maybe only have enough energy to make one hadron, that may not be OK. So if the quarks have exactly, let's say, the mass of the omega, then I should see a resonance at the position of the omega meson, or the phi meson. And indeed, you do. And that accounts for all the structure on the left-hand side of the diagram. Similarly, whenever I open up a threshold for a new quark, I should have the same thing. I should, when I just have enough energy, I should make the bound state of a charm and an anti-charm quark. And that turns out to produce an enormous, very narrow resonance on this channel, which are marked in red in that picture. And the physics of those things we'll talk about tomorrow. But aside from the threshold regions, this very naive theory that I've explained to you today works extremely well both for the total cross-section and for the angular distribution of jets. Oh, by the way, that big thing over on the right in this diagram is an effect that doesn't have to do with the strong interactions at all. That's the peak due to the Z boson, which is a quantum of the weak interactions. And we'll talk about that when we get to the weak interactions in the third week. Okay, this is probably a good place to stop. So any further questions? Yes.
This is the ratio of the cross-sections, right?
That's right.
They're proportional to the matrix elements squared.
That's right.
They're proportional to the charges squared. So why isn't it charged to the full?
No, sorry. This charge is 1.
Oh, right. It's enormous.
Right.
It's electric.
So this is the electron. This is the quark. So there's only one factor of q in the amplitude. So it's q squared. Okay. And it works too. Okay. Good. Tomorrow we'll talk about these resonances here. Okay.